Pastor Dwyer, welcoming you to Untitled. In our program this evening, we have two guests, I believe. George Devine, who is professor of music history at UT and also program annotator for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. And Rita Best, who will be here to talk with us about performances of music by Monteverdi and Stravinsky as part of the new Knoxville Chautauqua this coming weekend at the Carousel Theater. We will open with music by Respighi. We will have several of the Hungarian rhapsodies of Franz Liszt in a brand new recording of the complete set, the first recording, I think, to come out in a while of all of the Liszt Hungarian rhapsodies. We will have our music quiz at around 9:30 or 9:45 this evening. So I hope that you will plan to be with me throughout this program. We begin with a presumably new recording of Roman Festivals by Respighi. However, recordings by the Philadelphia Orchestra and Eugene Ormandy, you never really know whether they are re-releases or not, because some of the same recordings come out again with a new label, or rather a new cover, every 5 years or so. In this recording, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under the direction of Eugene Ormandy, in a performance of the symphonic poem Roman Festivals by Respighi. Roman Festivals by Respighi. The Philadelphia Orchestra was led by Eugene Ormandy. The time is now 29 minutes past 8 o'clock. You are listening to public radio in Knoxville, Tennessee, WUOT. The Lamar House Bijou Preservation Committee of Knoxville Heritage has announced that a new film strip presentation about the Bijou preservation effort is now available for showing to meetings of any community group or organization. Approximately 10 minutes in length, the presentation is complete with sound and describes the Bijou project as well as the history of this important downtown landmark. A Knoxville Heritage member will accompany the presentation to answer any specific questions about this project or other activities of Knoxville Heritage. Groups wishing to schedule the program should contact the Knoxville Heritage Bijou office at 522-0832, that's 522-0832, during office hours of 10 a.m. through 2 p.m. on weekdays, or Ron Childress at 573-8583 during the evening. There is no charge for the program, although contributions to the Bijou project will be welcome. It's now exactly 8:30, and we're very, very happy to welcome to WOT George Devine, professor of music history at the University of Tennessee Department of Music, and for some 28 or 9 seasons, the program annotator for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Devine, we're happy to have you with us.
Thank you, Norris. Glad to be.
We're going to talk about a variety of things. We thought that rather than stick to one subject, we're going to talk about several different things. Most of them have no relation to either the preceding or the following one. Is that correct?
Indeed it is.
But Mr. Devine can talk very interestingly about a number of subjects, and I'm sure we'll not be able to cover all of them this evening, and it's my hope to have him back on the program before long. In our conversation prior to this program, we were talking, Mr. Devine, about changes in orchestral programming over the years. Now, it seems to me that as recently as 15 or 20 years ago, most symphony concerts, by major and minor orchestras as well, began with an overture. And that practice seems to have gone by the boards to a large extent today. Do you have any theories as to why that should be?
Well, I don't know why it happened, but I know that there are many orchestral players who regret that it has happened, because an overture usually has a fairly rousing beginning, and you know, because you play, of course, you play a stringed instrument, but once upon a time when the world was young, I played a wind instrument in the orchestra. And the wind player dearly loves something at the beginning of the program that will enable him to make sure that there's a whole clear through from beginning to end. Is working and
wind problem. Wind players always have trouble with their reeds, don't they?
Oh yes, we suffer acutely. And well, for instance, during the Second World War, some of you who are listening may recall that every orchestra concert would begin with a more or less rousing performance of the Star Spangled Banner. Now, people who were present in the audience may have been motivated by patriotism. Possibly the conductor was motivated by patriotism. But I think it's safe to assume that the orchestra players, wind players particularly, valued the Star Spangled Banner most because it gave them a chance to give a few lusty blasts into their instruments and make sure that everything was functioning for the main event.
Right. On our program this evening, we're going to feature several of what we have, I hope correctly, deemed as more or less forgotten overtures, overtures that used to crop up very, very frequently as the beginning of symphony concerts, but ones that we unfortunately are not able to hear very often today. And we've chosen several, more or less at random, but we've decided to begin with the Rienzi Overture by Wagner. Tell us something about Rienzi.
Well, the reason that I asked Norris to put Rienzi on the program this evening is because it is a reverse illustration of what I was just speaking about, the wind player's desire to have a good noisy beginning, because Rienzi starts with a single and rather soft note for the trumpet. There's nothing intrinsically hard about it. If the trumpet player were at home or in his studio or any place else rather than on the stage, he would knock off that, it's a written G, with out any difficulty at all. But the mental hazard of playing a note which begins, as you will see this does, quite softly and swells in volume, is enough to unnerve the stoutest-hearted trumpet player, unless he happens not to know what the hazard is, and then of course he can go blithely into it.
Okay, so we'll begin the musical portion of our program then with the overture to the opera, and I think the complete title is Rienzi, the Last of the Tribunes by Wagner. And in this recording, we have the New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein. To the opera Rienzi by Wagner with the New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein. Mr. Devine, during that performance, started to relate to me story about a trumpet player, and I ask that he wait and share it with us all, so let's have it.
Well, it concerns the beginning of Rienzi, and it's told about a former first trumpet in the Philharmonic in New York, Mr. Harry Glantz, a man whose ability as a trumpeter was not questioned by anyone, I'm sure. One morning, in rehearsal, Mr. Glantz apparently was feeling a little bit seedy, and he leaned over to his colleague, the second trumpet, and said, "Hey, Gus, will you just start that first note for me? Give me a chance to get my lips set, you know." And the fellow smiled affably and said, "Sure." And so the downbeat came, and the second trumpet played, boop. And Mr. Glantz was still fishing around trying to find the relationship between his lips and the mouthpiece. It was not a very successful experiment.
Well, there are some pieces that string players both prefer and dread to see come along at the beginning of a program, too, when fingers are perhaps even less agile than usual. And let's mention a couple or three of those.
Yes, well, Norris was talking about the one which you'll hear in a moment, and then the Berlioz Overture, The Corsair, came up, and one which strikes as much terror into the heart of a bassoonist, at least on occasion, as it does to a string player, is the overture to Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro.
Mm-hmm. Another one comes to mind, too, the Oriante Overture of Weber has a rather imposing string figure right at the beginning. I mean, they just had to have something in mind against various members of the orchestra at times like that. But probably the least known of these four we've mentioned is the Weber Abu Hassan, and there's no explanation needed if you just imagine going out on a perhaps sometimes even slightly underheated stage and rather cold fingers and a little bit nervous and maybe a conductor even with a sloppy downbeat, who knows, and start a concert with this particular string figure. This is the Abu Hassan Overture by Weber. The conductor is Ernest Ansermé, and he leads l'Orchestre de la Suisse Romande. Abu Hassan by Weber with l'Orchestre de la Suisse Romande under the direction of Ernest Ansermé. So we've talked a little bit about how orchestra concerts used to start with the War Horse Overture, or at least a rousing overture of one sort or another. Let's talk, Mr. Devine, a few moments about orchestral programming, and specifically the pretty common practice now of each program featuring a solo artist of some sort or other. Conductors have rather diverse opinions of where on the program a solo artist should appear. What do you think?
I didn't know you were going to ask me a question like that. We were talking about the matter last week one day, and as it seemed to me, the whole business was left hanging in air because so many factors govern the location of the solo spot on the program. Some of them are practical things like, do you want to please the segment of the audience who, and I've seen this happen, make a pretty consistent practice of leaving at intermission, which means you would have to schedule the soloist before intermission, or do you schedule it after intermission, possibly for the benefit of those who come late to concerts, that is, audience, not soloists, or for the benefit of the soloist. The soloist, if he has any red blood flowing through his veins, would like best to be the last thing on the program, unless he doesn't know his concerto or whatever it is very well. Because if he has, or at least hopes he has, a firm command of the situation, then the ideal place to be is at the very end of the program, and the customers presumably will walk out of the hall happily humming ditties from the concerto or aria or whatever it happens to be that the soloist has just performed. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible to resolve the matter. The conductor can resolve it because he's the boss, and this the way matters, I think, should be.
It probably depends to some extent, too, on the sort of music being performed. If a soloist is to do a Haydn concerto, it's less likely that that's going to conclude the program than if he does one of the big Beethoven or Brahms concertos, I suppose.
Yes, or Rachmaninoff,
right,
or Prokofiev, or right, any of those things that are surefire conclusions to a program. That's right.
What about the question of orchestras having soloists that are very, very well known, very, very famous people, as opposed to young artists on the way up who whose names are not familiar with the concert goers?
Well, again, I think that's a difficult question to answer.
There's no reason to bring you over here and ask you all easy questions.
Yes, well, okay, I will now pontificate. It's been my observation that young, extremely gifted performers have made performances every bit as good as performances by some of the established soloists whose fees nowadays are approaching the astronomical category. I think that, well, for one thing, and I've seen this happen, in the case of instrumentalists, perhaps particularly pianists, if the listener were to hear the performer without knowing who it was, in other words, as in the case of a radio performance or recorded performance which was not identified, very often this listener would not be able to tell who was giving the performance. And in that case, why pay someone a couple of thousand dollars to perform for the sake of a name when the organization might get every bit as fine a performance out of a young performer? I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm. How, as far as a recall or a household word, if we want to bring back that household name, bring back that term that was mm-hmm. popular around this country a few years ago, how many pianists, violinists, singers do you think are familiar on a name basis with most people who comprise our symphony audiences today?
You can tell from the silence that Norris has just asked me a question that I don't have a pat answer to. It's been my observation, though, that reputation among performers and conductors is a pretty fleeting thing. Most of our young people here in the music department, for instance, never, in fact, I dare say none of them ever had the opportunity to hear Rachmaninoff live, perhaps, probably not to hear Prokofiev live. And even some of the people who were up-and-coming artists back in the time of the Second War, I think of Billy Capel, who was tragically killed, I think, in a plane accident mm-hmm. or something like that. Many of our young people have not heard these people live, and they don't know the force that can be generated by a fine live performance mm-hmm. by some of these very persons.
Well, I was thinking also, though, as far as an orchestra planning a program that they hope will sell tickets, I'm wondering, except for these people in the really top categories, the Andre Watts and Clyburn and Isaac Stern and Lantine Price and Beverly Sills, all of whom charge between $10,000 and $15,000 now for a single performance. When you get down below that mighty half dozen or so, I think the artists that really have name recall among members of the audience, in other words, prospective symphony audiences here in Knoxville or even larger cities, would go specifically to hear them. I'm suggesting that the list is rather short, really.
Yes, well,
you agree or disagree?
I'm not sure. In the light of what I said a moment ago, I'd be obliged to say that I in principle disagreed, but yet I was only voicing my own feeling. I wonder sometimes when I attend the Knoxville Symphony concerts, I look around me at the size of the audience, and the reputation of the performer is not necessarily a guarantee of a full house.
No.
And I think that's very bad, because if the Symphony Society has paid out a pretty handsome sum of money to a person whose reputation they hope will fill the house, and then the house isn't filled, this is most unfortunate. Then why not have the younger player who in so many cases can perform with as much conviction and ability.
And charge $10,000 less.
Yes. Well, charge considerably less at any rate. Yes.
Quite often close to that. And it's too bad that monetary aspects have to enter into the picture, but the arts being in the financial situation that they are, unfortunately, they do.
Well, I think back to opportunities I had when I was considerably younger to hear some of these people whose names were being bandied about a few moments ago. And I wouldn't exchange that experience for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, it would be good, I think, if audiences would not adopt this, what is perhaps in a sense a kind of snobbish view of the whole matter.
Mm-hmm. One other question about this topic, and then we'll hear some more music and move on to something else. Most orchestra concerts now, and I think this applies to orchestras of all sizes, from community right up to the major orchestras, feel inclined to offer a soloist on almost each and every program. You think we've gotten carried away a little bit? Perhaps all orchestral programs are too few? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, yes, I do, because I enjoy the urinal orchestral program. But again, looking around the theater, the auditorium, to see the size of the audience for an all-orchestral program, far too often it's a rather meager crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the soloist of some reputation, of any reputation, is more likely to bring people into the auditorium
mm-hmm.
than a program without soloists. And this is a situation which I don't consider to be good at all.
Well, I think it's the case, though. Well, we'll hear another one of these overtures that we used to get to hear opening programs and don't so much anymore. And then we'll return with Mr. Devine to talk about another matter, one that I understand he feels so strongly about that I may even have to leave the room here when he gets going on it. This is the overture to the operetta, or is it a complete opera? I don't even know. The Beautiful Galatea?
It was an operetta.
Okay.
Yes.
By Franz von Suppé. The New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein. The overture to the operetta The Beautiful Galatea by Franz von Suppé, with the New York Philharmonic led by Leonard Bernstein. We should mention that you are listening to public radio in Knoxville, Tennessee, WUOT, a community service of the University of Tennessee, and we're happy to have our guest this evening, Mr. George Devine, professor of music history at the University of Tennessee Department of Music, and for many, many seasons, program annotator for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. We've talked a little bit about programming, a little bit about soloists. Let's talk a little bit about concert etiquette. Anything that concert audiences do nowadays that you don't like?
Well, I'm sorry you put it that way, because there are several things sometimes done by audiences that I don't like. And let me just mention this one parenthetically.
And having been, you know, a part of various orchestras for many years, I don't want to seem churlish about the manners of the people who are kind enough to come hear us play. But in recent years particularly, many members of the audience in various situations have a habit of drifting in as if they were coming in to see the Saturday afternoon cowboy movies, which they used to show when I was a kid anyway. And, you know, you came in when you felt like it and you left when you felt like it, which was about two or three shows later. But that, I suppose, is a minor matter. But there is one matter having to do with what might be called concert etiquette that arouses my worst instincts, and that is the standing ovation.
I certainly agree.
That gesture, which can be a gesture of supreme tribute, has lost almost all of its force nowadays. I see it happening. It almost seems as if the audience rises to its feet simply to applaud the fact that an ensemble has managed not only to start together, but to finish together. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say this. And
oh, go ahead.
Okay, I will. Thank you. I will, but I have anyway, I guess. But I remember many years ago in Chicago when I was a kid, and I'd go and then hear Mr. Stock conducting the orchestra, and there would be someone like Rachmaninoff or Prokofiev or Stravinsky or heaven only knows, and many others. And a concerto or some other such work would be performed that would so electrify the audience, and you would just feel the sensation that pervaded the whole house. And if you were watching what was going on stage, you'd see over to the left, you'd see Mr. Hancock, the personnel manager, give a sort of semi-secret sign to the trumpet and trombone players in the orchestra, who would thereupon stand up and play what is called a touche, a fanfare, you know, a great sort of random C major chord. And I give you my word that the most sluggish member of the audience was virtually dragged to his feet by that. And when that happened, it had some significance. Mm-hmm. What do you do now to acknowledge that you've been in the presence of a supremely fine performance of a given work?
There's nothing left, really, anymore.
Right.
That's right.
There was a cartoon in the New Yorker a couple of years ago, the customary New York couple of middle age, and the wife says rather pettishly to her husband, 17 years we've been married, and all I get from you is a 3-minute standing ovation. It's gotten to be a joke. And I think the whole practice ought to be severely restricted.
It's hard to control, though, is it not?
Oh, indeed it is. You feel like a heel when you sit there, you know, and see everyone around you standing up, and perhaps the people who have just finished performing are your dear friends, you know, and you appreciate what they've done. But was it worth a standing ovation? These things should be more carefully considered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, audiences are not always as discerning as we might wish, but as you prefaced your remarks, let it not be thought that any performer has anything but very positive attitudes toward anyone who comes to his concert.
Yes,
right?
Indeed.
Let's talk about something now, which is certainly a favorite topic of mine nowadays, and I hope yours as well, the project downtown to attempt to save and renovate the the old Bijou Theater?
Well, I can only add my hearty assent to that. When we came to Knoxville in 1947, the orchestra was playing its concerts down there. And at that time, Dr. Soper brought his strolling players down there from the campus to present the major portion of their theater season. And there was at least one other series, the Civic Music Series, in there. That is just such a beautiful, I'm speaking now about the sound of it, such a beautiful, beautiful little theater that it would hurt, I think it would physically hurt many of us who have had the happy experience of hearing either music or drama or both performed in that theater, to see the place torn down in the name of progress or economic expediency or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to be on a soapbox, but I urge wholehearted support for the project to save the Bijou Theater and to put it to the use for which it was originally intended. Some of you may have been, as I was, to a concert there by the Knoxville Symphony back in the spring. And I looked around at that poor, dear old theater and saw great areas of the ceiling and walls where the plaster was gone, and a variety of color schemes, and the miserable, tattered carpet, and the patched seats and whatnot. And I thought, what a pity that the place should have gotten into such simply miserable shape. I dare say it was in good enough shape for the purpose to which it had been most recently put. But you don't lose the sound of a theater by the loss of some paint, you know, and the initial freshness of the carpeting and upholstery. The sound is still there. That experience that Sunday afternoon was just beautiful, and I rather think that many people who were there felt as I did. This theater just simply may not be lost to Knoxville.
Very, very nicely put, and of course there are many opportunities for listeners of whom, or it will be very likely turned into a parking lot sometime in July. The ways that you can contribute to the Bijou Project, one of three ways, actually. You can drop your checks by to the Bijou office at 803 Gay Street Southwest at the corner of Gay and Cumberland. You can call the Bijou at 522-0832. That's 522-0832. During the hours of 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. each weekday. You can also mail your contributions to Box 1746, Knoxville 37902. That's Box 1746, Knoxville 37902. Well, we haven't really talked too much about your long-held position as program annotator of the Knoxville Symphony. Let's listen to another one of these rousing but unfortunately nearly forgotten overtures, and then we'll talk about one of your positions as program annotator of the KSO. This is the overture, and that's our new phone answering device there in the background. That's okay, I'll get it in a second. I just wanted to warn our listeners that it's not civil defense warning or anything. This is the overture to La Dame Blanche by Francois Baldieu with the London Symphony Orchestra led by Richard Bonning. The overture to the opera La Dame Blanche by Francois Baldieu with a London Symphony Orchestra led by Richard Bonney. Mr. Devine has, for some 28 seasons or so, I think, is that the correct number? 29?
How long?
That's close, anyway.
been the program annotator for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. I've often wondered, Mr. Devine, when we know to begin with that the musical background, knowledge, interest, whatever you want to say, of an audience is so divergent, how do you approach writing program notes to try to appeal to as many in the audience as possible?
Well, I'm not sure if I do it that way. If it comes out that way, I'm very, very happy. But if there's a work that interests me particularly from a technical point of view, I'm likely to include scads of little snippets of examples, musical examples and whatnot, which may bear more fruit in the course of time than anyone else may realize. Some of the things I write about, fortunately, were written by composers whose lives were rather colorful, and that's always good for a paragraph or two, if I should choose to exploit that angle. Sometimes, possibly, I'm afraid this has happened at any rate, I just get off the track and onto some vaguely related subject. I don't think that you can, I suppose one may make a hard and fast rule for writing well-ordered program notes for relatively uninformed people, uninformed in the particular area of music. But I just make a sort of general shotgun approach. Mostly I do what it pleases me to do. Mm-hmm. I am happy to say that no one has ever tried to direct the writing of those notes. Consequently, they're as uneven as the deuce. I must say that every once in a while someone will come up to me at the end of a season and say, "What's happened to you? I used to enjoy reading your notes. I haven't seen an interesting one all year, season long, you know." And I think back, and naturally, being me, I think, well, that, you know, wasn't exactly a fair charge, because I can think of this and that, and yet sometimes people read into program notes what they would like to read into them. I recall hearing one instance of an occurrence which happened when we were still playing down at the Bijou. And a friend of mine told me a week or so after the concert that behind her had been sitting two earnest patrons of the orchestra, who apparently not only listened to what the orchestra was doing, which is what they should primarily be doing, but they also had time to read the program book. And one turned to the other and said, "My, I'm so glad to see that Mr. Devine doesn't like Mozart either." And this, of course, is not exactly the truth. In fact, it's so far from it. But we can read into things what we want to read into, and I think that applies to program notes, too. Program notes are useful for many, many things. I can recall when I was a kid, going to symphony concerts in Chicago, inescapable. I will put it that way, too, because I viewed it just exactly that way. One of the inescapable items of every symphony program that occurred on Good Friday, the Friday before Easter, was the so-called Good Friday spell from Richard Wagner's opera or music drama, Parsifal. And that's pretty bearable. But Mr. Stock, bless his heart,
would also include a rather lengthy additional excerpt from Parsifal, and that just bored me stiff. And at that time in my life, I was sitting in the gallery seats, which were as hard as rocks, although not as uneven. But had it not been for dear old Dr. Borowski's program notes, I would have been
fit to be tied.
Well, indeed, like yes. Indeed, yes. But while the Parsifal interminable excerpt was going on, I could sit there and read Mr. Borowski's words, and in a program book, very often you have the good fortune to find an attractive succession of advertisements to look at, and they're just all kinds of that. Program books are very useful, legitimate things if you don't take them too seriously and don't imagine that the writer of the material has been granted some mystic vision that you haven't been granted, mm-hmm. but just take it as the expression of another person's opinion.
Right.
Then you may fare well enough with program notes. Hmm. Sometimes people don't read them till after they have gotten home.
Well, that's all right, too. It probably serves yes. as a way to, rehear the concert or have some different opinions about it. Yeah.
And nowadays, when so many people have record collections, on the periodic occasions when I include musical examples, they may get out their phonograph record of the work in question and actually see some relationship between the stuff that I've been scribbling into the program, you know, and what they have on their phonograph record. Mm-hmm. And they may end up with a considerably greater comprehension of the music.
Well, as almost always occurs during periods like this, we don't get through the whole list of things we had meant to talk about, and so that simply means that we'll have to have you back on this program soon, and I hope that it's been relatively painless and that you would agree to appear some other time. Is that correct?
Of course I will.
Well, good.
Anyone who gives me the opportunity to talk is my friend.
Well, fine. That's great. Our guest has been Mr. George Devine, program annotator for the Knoxville Symphony and professor of music history at the University of Tennessee Department of Music, and it's been a very great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.